Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The new Samsung store inside your local Best Buy. After Cyprus, Europe's little countries fret about their futures. And guess which American industry is actually growing union membership? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, April 4th. I'm Sarah Gardner, in for Kai Ristall. Thanks for joining us. We have a habit on this show of always leading with our economy, so we're going to do something different today and lead with somebody else's disappointing economy, Europe's. Theirs, however, is actually shrinking and unemployment is rising. And today, the chief of the European Central Bank said they're considering some big moves to reinvigorate the eurozone, moves not unlike some of those of the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. Also today, the head of the ECB acknowledged that the initial plan to bail out the troubled country of Cyprus was, in his words, not so smart. That plan sent global stock markets tumbling, as you recall. The redraft is getting a better reception, but still has its critics. You can find them in the smallest European countries. Marketplace's Stephen Beard takes us on an armchair tour of the eurozone's teensiest and now anxious member states.
A love of the Umpar band is one of the many things that Luxembourg shares with its mighty neighbour, Germany. But tiny, inoffensive Luxembourg has been raising hackles in Berlin because of the size of its banking industry.
Luxembourg's banking sector is massive. It is almost solely an international financial centre.
And, says political analyst Raoul Ruperel, it's believed to be harbouring billions of tax-avoiding euros from Germany. After the Cyprus debacle, Berlin is posing an ominous question.
Whether a country can exist with these sorts of controversial economic and political approaches within the eurozone.
In the small alpine state of Slovenia, in contrast with the jaunty music, the national mood is grim following the Cypriot fiasco. Slovenian banks are also in trouble. Borrowing costs have rocketed. European officials say this country could be next in line for a bailout. But from the capital, Ljubljana, economist Sašo Stanovnik says Slovenia's been picked on because it's small.
We have a very negative trend, but we're not in a situation in where Italy, let's say, is, or Spain. So in a way, yes, we are being punished for being small.
Now to the smallest country in the eurozone, Malta, which is feeling even more beleaguered. Like Cyprus, here's another Mediterranean island laden with banks, Maltese newspaper executive Anthony Manduka.
You know, we are both small islands, we both have an important financial services sector, but that's where it ends. And I think it's not fair to sort of link the two together at all.
But all the microstates are linked by the same fear that investors will pull their money out and that the rest of the eurozone will then bully them into higher taxes and spending cuts in return for help, threatening them with expulsion from the eurozone if they don't toe the line. Jan Randolph of IHS Global Insight says that for the small countries, that is now a credible threat.
That is the atomic button that the eurozone can use. They are unlikely to use it in the case of Italy or Spain, but they can use it in the case of Cyprus and maybe Malta and Slovenia.
He says Europe's central bank has now made it possible for a small country to be ejected from the euro without the whole thing unravelling. The small countries are now feeling much smaller. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The investigative arm of Congress today released its first study of an industry called political intelligence. Ever heard of it? Well, probably not, and that's probably the way the industry wants it. You should know about it, though, because it's the latest way for Wall Street to keep track of what's happening in Washington and profit from it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story.
When we say intelligence, we're not talking spying or CIA cloak and dagger stuff. Political intelligence gatherers get their information from palling around with congressional staffers. They meet with people working at federal agencies, sucking up information as they go. Craig Holman follows the political intelligence biz for Public Citizen, a government watchdog group.
They tap into that insider information and then sell it to their clients for the whole purpose of cashing in on the stock market.
What kind of insider information? Adam Zagarin is a senior fellow at the Project on Government Oversight. He says, imagine if you knew ahead of time which defense contractor would get a big project. You'd buy that stock and make a killing.
And so the decisions made in Washington about the timing and amounts of money that are going to be spent are of interest to many people.
In fact, Zagarin cites one estimate that about a third of institutional investors have hired political intelligence firms. But the political intelligence business is really hard to measure. It operates in the shadows, which is why Congress asked the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, to study it. Michelle Sager wrote the study released today.
We started with the definition, and then we tried to quantify exactly what the industry looked like.
But Sager couldn't get a really good look at it. She couldn't find out who's behind the political intelligence business or how much they profit from it. That's because they don't have to register or report who they meet with. Legislation could be introduced soon in Congress to change that. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Apple has its own stores. Microsoft has its own stores. Now, Samsung says it's getting into the game, sort of. Next month, the electronics company will open special shops in hundreds of Best Buys. They'll have their own trained staffs and, most cleverly, have separate checkout lines. As Sally Herships reports, Samsung's new retail foothold may also give Best Buy's bricks and mortar strategy the boost it needs.
It's safe to say Best Buy has an issue with space.
Well, they've got too much of it.
Mara Devitt works with the retail consulting firm McMillan Doolittle. I caught her on her cell at the airport. She'd been helping a client look for retail space in New York City and says that is one expenditure of time and money Samsung can skip. Now that CDs and DVDs are mostly sold online,
it leaves a lot of room in those stores for more compelling products.
Best Buy has been fighting showrooming. That's when consumers check out products at the store, but then buy them online.
The last thing Samsung and Best Buy want you to do is to shop in Best Buy and then buy someplace else.
Richard Doherty works for Envisioneering, a market research firm. He says Samsung's plan will help both companies. Samsung can reach more customers for its new Galaxy smartphone and other electronics. Best Buy will get a piece of the action and a percentage of the cell phone contracts sold in its stores. Analysts say the partnership should also help Best Buy continue its turnaround. But can't Samsung just put its goods on Best Buy shelves like other brands?
You can put a product in a store and hope that the customer gets it.
Will Ander works with Mara Devitt at McMillan Doolittle.
If you're there physically at the retail touch point, you have ability to influence that customer, to market that customer, to educate that customer.
And to sell to that customer. Ander says there's something to be said for old-fashioned bricks and mortar and human salespeople. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Best Buy stock got a big boost from that announcement today. That and other market details when we do the numbers. The politics of the Keystone XL pipeline are, forgive me, heating up again. Keystone's aimed at bringing more Canadian oil sands to the lower 48, but a pipeline spill in Arkansas last week has environmental activists saying, see, we told you fossil fuels were trouble. And opponents in the president's own party are donating big money to oppose Keystone and other oil investments. From our sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong joins me now. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Sarah.
Tell us, this pipeline break, how serious is it?
Well, we're still awaiting word on why it ruptured. As far as how much came out of the pipeline, ExxonMobil, the company operating the pipeline, says a few thousand barrels, which qualifies as a major spill, as the government defines it. As far as what was in the pipeline, it's oil sands, also called tar sands. Many of us who think about crude oil, we've seen pictures, you know, that kind of look like apple juice or root beery colored liquid. This is not that. I mean, oil sands is thick, jet black goop. that gets diluted with some other hydrocarbons and sent down the pipe. Right now, a fair amount of that already comes to the lower 48 through an existing pipeline that's called Keystone. Now, the proposed extension, which is Keystone XL, that's the big fight, that would carry more of it. So right now, opponents say, you know, this shows that this is dangerous, thick stuff, and this is not the first time we've had a pipeline rupture of oil sands crude. This shows where we should oppose it. The other side says, well, if you're going to transport crude oil that the whole world wants to buy, pipelines are safer than, say, rail cars. So we're back to this old fossil fuel inkblot test, Sarah. You know, each side sees what it wants to see here.
Right, right. But environmental activists are really taking this opportunity. They're really jumping on this.
They've been jumping. I mean, it's getting louder. It is really amazing for all the pipelines we have in North America how big this one, this fight has become. Last night, a billionaire Democratic Keystone opponent in San Francisco hosted President Obama at a fundraiser at his house. Tom Steyer is a retired hedge fund manager, and he's bankrolling Democratic candidates who are against Keystone XL. So now on the left, you have this big political money from the inside fighting it. And then you have thousands of activists on the outside who've been protesting at the gates of the White House, and they want to be kind of the Tunisian fruit seller to stoke this anti-fossil fuel spring in the country. The question is whether they've convinced the president. Last night, Mr. Obama said at this fundraiser that the politics of this are tough.
But in the end, what do you think the odds are that Keystone will pass?
Oh, you know, we're not in the predicting business because we're not very good at it. But the market is sending some signals that it expects it to go through. Up in Alberta, it is getting harder to make money producing this oil sands product. There aren't enough pipes to get it all the way to market. And I'm told that some of the projects are getting delayed. But if you look long-term at these big investment projections, the sense is, you know, if you make something that people around the world are going to pay $100 for a barrel, you know, that's probably going to make it to market eventually.
Right.
Now, one last thing, Sarah, is the political tea leaves here. I hear more people inside the administration or who were recently in the administration who say that these kinds of decisions increasingly are wagged by politics, that the regulation has to fall in line with the rhetoric, which right now is all of the above. The president likes green energy and he likes brown energy, too. Sarah?
Yeah. Yeah, so the all-of-the-above strategy. Scott Tong on the Sustainability Beat. Scott, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Coming up...
Everything is now, you know, fast food... one-stop shopping, and I think what's happening is that people are not establishing relationships with their butcher, and as such, everybody needs to label something the same way.
Boston roasts and flank steaks coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rebounded 55 points, up 0.3% to finish at 14,606. The NASDAQ clicked up 6 points, 0.2% to end at 3224. The S&P 500 added 6 points, 0.4% to close at 1559. Hewlett-Packard gained 1.75%, but the big news came after the bell. HP announced yet another board shakeup. Ray Lane will step down as chairman following the botched acquisition of a British software company. Best Buy powered up 16% today after Samsung said it will open those mini stores in many Best Buy locations. Bond prices climbed. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports unemployment numbers for March. Smart kids who know their geography compete at the state level for a place in the National Geographic Bee. Remember, kids, there are 5 Great Lakes. And the wholesome family television program Married with Children premiered 25 years ago. It ran for 11 seasons. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Sarah Gardner, in for Kai Rizdahl.
Michigan's attorney general was back in court this week defending the state's new right-to-work law against a lawsuit by labor groups. The law just took effect last week, and it's the latest blow to organized labor in this country. Union membership is down by 2 million just in the past 4 years. But as Jason Slotkin reports, there's at least one industry right now where unions are actually gaining members.
Mike Davis is a union member in Maryland. And to see examples of his work, just drive around Baltimore.
I really should turn left on Baltimore Street.
He builds film sets as a member of the Studio Mechanics Local 487. Davis points to a brick storefront he once turned into a burlesque club for director Barry Levinson. A city liquor inspector happened upon his handiwork and threatened to shut down what he thought was an illegal bar.
I think it was a set dresser says, excuse me, sir, this is a movie set.
Since 2011, Davis's local has added more than 150 new members. It's one of five film production unions in the Mid-Atlantic working on shows like HBO's Veep and the Netflix series House of Cards. Last year, those two productions alone pumped $70 million into Maryland's economy.
Power is a lot like real estate. It's all about location, location, location.
Maryland wants to make sure House of Cards stays on location in Baltimore. Like many states, it offers tax credits to film productions. But in fall 2011, it had blown through $22.5 million in tax credits that were meant to last through next year. Lawmakers now want to add $40 million to the program. And local film unions have become a key lobbying partner.
If you want to keep the work going, this is what you need to do. It's the reality of how business is done in this industry today.
That's David O'Farrell. He's the business agent for Studio Mechanics Local 487.
These are unions that are really asking themselves the question, what do we have to do to maintain our base and grow our base and maintain our leverage?
Sue Sherman studies unions at Rutgers University. She says film unions are one of the enduring success stories of the labor movement. That's because they have something other unions lack: star power. Support from the celebrity-studded actor and directors guilds have helped trade unions at the negotiating table. Or, in other words,
you can't make movies without them.
While film unions are having success lobbying state legislatures, other unions have paid the price of state budget cuts. The Maryland chapter of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees has lost 3,500 members since 2007. Patrick Moran is chapter president. He said his members don't begrudge the film unions for their success on tax credits.
You can see the tangible results. You see them on television. You watch them. You know, so you know where that money went.
And Moran says the political appeal of film production tax credits go far beyond the jobs they support.
Hey, they're going to film something in my hometown. Or I'm going to see these actors walking down the sidewalk. And not only that, they're going to spend money in my city, in my state. That has some attractiveness to it.
The bill to expand the tax credit program passed Maryland's legislature with overwhelming support this week. And Governor Martin O'Malley is expected to sign it as early as next week. I'm Jason Slotkin from Marketplace.
Remember when a growing business had to worry about finding more space for file cabinets to store all its records? Well, in the internet age, even if companies aren't growing, the amount of data they're collecting from every purchase, web search, or cell phone call is growing exponentially, and they are paying big money to store it. Many are outsourcing the task to companies that house digital file cabinets, you might call them. The server farms are cashing in on the tidal wave of information. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
I'm standing inside SuperNAP 7. It's one of the largest server farms in the world. Located just outside of Las Vegas, the building is the size of seven football fields. Missy Young works for Switch, which built SuperNAP 7. She takes me through the wide, dimly lit aisles that are lined with blinking machines in locked cages.
What is the sound that we're hearing?
Just thousands and thousands of servers all humming along.
Stored in those servers? That restaurant you were searching for online. Google is here. The coffee you charged last week. The big banks are here. The trip you wrote off as a business expense. TurboTax is here. Also, that scarf you bid on.
From this wall all the way to the back wall, so from here on down, this is all eBay.
Does a big company like eBay, I mean, do they spend like millions and millions of dollars storing data?
Billions. Not millions, billions.
The data storage market is already worth $70 billion a year, according to data company EMC,
firms like Amazon and Dell have jumped into the business.
The demand for storage is growing at an unprecedented rate.
Dick Sapler is an analyst for research firm Aberdeen. In a report last year, he found companies are now spending about 12% of their IT budget on storing data, and those needs are doubling every 2 years.
So you think about what percentage of your IT budget goes towards storage, and now start doubling that every 2 years. Either you've got to rob from other portions of your IT budget, or you've got to figure out smarter ways to deal with this.
The cost of storing data became a major issue at social media startup Semex. Chief Technology Officer Michael Hoey says the company was storing its data itself, but the cost of buying and maintaining the servers threatened to eat up half the company's IT budget.
When you start to have, you know, hundreds of hard drives, one of them is always broken. So you wind up needing a full-time person just to be there.
Last year, Semex moved its data to a storage service run by Amazon. Renting that space isn't cheap. Storage still accounts for about 15% of Semex's IT budget. Missy Young at SuperNAP 7 in Las Vegas says demand has been so strong that SuperNAPs 8 and 9 are already under construction. And the amount of data being stored in these buildings is mind-blowing. Young points out one cluster of servers about the size of a dozen refrigerators.
Okay, it's estimated that the entire written works of man from the dawn of time until today in every single language is the equivalent of 50 petabytes of data. This one cage, we're told, is a little over 100 petabytes.
So everything man ever wrote from Exodus.
God has set before you this day his laws of life.
To Twilight.
Say it out loud.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No.
Could fit in a cluster of machines in the corner of this building. Twice. So imagine how much corporate and consumer data they have on us. And me. I found out my bank stores data in the building when Missy Young pointed out a row of servers.
So in fact, I'm already here.
That's right. Yes, you are. If you have a bank or health records or anything like that, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. In Las Vegas, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Okay, quiz time, all you meat eaters out there. What's a beef shoulder top blade steak? How about a bone-in pork loin chop? And what's the difference between that and a pork loin top loin chop? Yeah, I thought so. You don't know either. That's the whole point of a new labeling system the meat industry is about to roll out, one aimed at using more common terms for meat cuts like porterhouse or T-bone or Boston roast. Although I'd never heard of that one until today. It's part of a marketing effort by the industry to boost sagging sales. Joining us now from his butcher shop in Manhattan is David Lobel at Lobel's of New York. Mr. Lobel, thanks for talking to us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's start out by establishing your meat credentials. Tell us, what is the difference between a pork loin top loin chop and a bone-in pork loin chop? It sounds the same to me.
Well, the pork loin has a variety of cuts to it. There's actually the rib on one side and the loin on the other. And the loin, also commonly called the short loin in beef, houses the porterhouse steak and the T-bone steak. On one end of the loin, you have a larger fillet, and that's where the porterhouse resides. And as you go down the loin, the short loin, the fillet becomes increasingly smaller, and that becomes the T-bone steak.
Okay, I think you know what you're talking about. What do you think of this new labeling system that's coming up?
It's a very interesting concept. You know, I know there's some confusion among various consumers about the different categories and the different names of meats, but to me, I think doing this is possibly going to cause even more confusion.
Really?
For example, lots of people have been calling certain cuts of meat a certain name for their entire lives. And to be told now that that's no longer acceptable, I think is not really fair to them.
I guess the assumption in all of this new labeling system is if you label things in a more common way, that actually you could increase meat sales. Do you think labels are going to do anything to increase sales?
No, I don't think labels is the solution. You know, the person that walks in and has been referring to something a certain way their entire life, and they're looking through the supermarket, and they don't see that name anymore. What do they do now? You want to buy a New York strip steak. That's also called a shell steak. It's also called a sirloin steak. It's also called a Kansas City steak. So if someone walks in and they've called it a shell steak their entire life and they ask for a shell steak, and now they say, I'm sorry, we don't have that, you know, what is it, a strip steak?
Yeah. Now, you're standing in your meat shop right now. What's your best seller? What have you got in front of you?
The most popular steaks we sell are the New York strip, the filet mignon, the porterhouse, and the rib steak in the meat category. Those seem to fly out the door with a high frequency.
And have you found that over the years, how have customer tastes changed as people overall seem to be eating less red meat?
That's a very good question. People are turning more to chicken, to turkey, also to pork.
Pork.
Which is a lot different than the red meat. But we also, you know, have a very loyal following in the meat category.
What is your favorite cut of meat?
I happen to love a skirt steak.
A skirt steak? Why is that?
A skirt steak is a flat piece that it's just what you can grill it real quickly on a skillet or on a grill, 1 or 2 minutes on each side, and it has tremendous flavor.
Okay, now I'm hungry. All right. Thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Dave Lobel is with Lobel's New York Meats. Mr. Lobel, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And finally, you know all that hype and speculation about the new Facebook phone that, yeah, Marketplace also participated in yesterday? Well, it turns out it's not a phone. It's new software aimed at putting Facebook front and center on Android phones. The software is called Home. Instead of all those apps on your home screen, you'd see photos and updates from your Facebook friends. So instead of checking your email first thing, you'd automatically be drawn into your Facebook world, exactly where Mark Zuckerberg would love you to spend more of your time. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rebounded 55 points, up 1/3%. The NASDAQ clicked up 6 points, 2/10%. The S&P 500 added 6 points, 4/10%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.